Okay, so we're going to be looking at Jesus' death and looking at the four accounts of his death. I've been reading through Matthew lately, and I came across a verse that I thought was, I don't know, just really cool, something that struck me. I don't know if I've really paid attention to over the years. So we're going to be reading the four accounts, so each gospel, and kind of just going through those and seeing the similarities and the differences. And that's something I want to start looking into a little bit more in the Gospels, I think, as I teach in the future, and just looking at just some of the differences, the different accounts of things, the different flavors of the Gospels, and something I want to dig more into. I've read them all like many times, but I haven't really paid attention to necessarily how they're written. One thing I wanted to do real quick, I'm going to share my screen real quickly. Not that one. It's hard because this sharing thing gets in the way. Hold on a second. Okay. So I wanted to read this. I was looking for some articles, just seeing what some things that people think about why and how the Gospels are different and why that's important. So let me share again. Okay. Oh, there we go. Okay. Hopefully you can see this. All right. So I'm going to be reading this one right here. Can you guys see that on my screen?
Yeah.
Okay. So I found this it was focused on the family, but I liked what it said. So starting up here at the top, it says, why are there four gospel accounts of the resurrection? We'll start right here. It says, the simple answer might be that it's too big, with too many implications, to be recorded by a single human author. To be sure, the accounts share many common elements, the empty tomb, the testimony of the women, the slowness of the disciples to believe, the importance of Mary Magdalene as the first witness of the resurrection, and of course, the various appearances of the risen Jesus. But each gospel also speaks with its own voice and has its own emphasis. Matthew presents the royal power of Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of David. Mark cuts to the chase with an unadorned account that rings with truth and the grace of Christ. Luke marshals a wealth of realistic detail to make his persuasive case for the risen Lord. And John paints a warm, human, divine portrait of Jesus interacting with his disciples and friends so that readers might believe and find life in his name. This variety of perspectives, agreeing in essence but diverse in details, is exactly what one would expect from any credible set of eyewitness accounts. Taken together, they offer a unified, compelling mosaic of testimony inspired and preserved by God to the most important event in the history of the world. So, I wanted to look at the scriptures. So, if people have a Bible, I would love to have other people read, not just me. We can look at, I know translations change things a little bit, but I wanted to read, if somebody can do Matthew 27, 50 through 56. So Matthew 27, 50 through 56. Can somebody do that one?
Yeah, I'll do it.
Oh, you all raise your hands. Okay, you do that one, Aaron. Jake, if you'll do Mark 15, 39 through 41. And Mom, if you'll do Luke 23, 44 through 49. And then I'll finish up with, because Cassie, I know you're driving, so I'll finish up with John 19:30. All right. You got that, Aaron?
Just about there.
Mark what?
Mark 15:39 through 41. Oh, we lost Cassie, so she's probably in the canyon.
All right. Let's see. Matthew 27, 50 to 56?
Yeah.
Okay. It says, when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he yielded up his spirit. At that moment, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth quaked and the rocks were split. The tombs broke open, and the bodies of many spirits who had fallen asleep were raised. After Jesus' resurrection, when they had come out of the tombs, they entered the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and said, "Truly, this was the Son of God." And many women were there watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to minister to him. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and Mary, the mother of Zebedee's sons.
Okay. Yeah. Sweet. Jake? Go ahead, Jake, on the mark
one. Okay, cool. Sorry, I wasn't sure if you were going to say anything.
You're good.
And I'm going to read from the NIV just in case you guys can switch translations digitally.
Sweet.
And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Some women were watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary, mother of James, the younger, and of Joseph, and Salome. In Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. Many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there.
And can you read the verse right before that section too, where it says about he breathed his last? Might have given you the wrong number to start on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last breath.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. All right, Mom.
I added the breath part. It's my own version.
Okay, Luke 23, 44 through 49. And then I've got the Passion Bible.
Okay.
Okay. It was now only midday, yet the whole world became dark for 3 hours as the light of the sun faded away. And suddenly in the temple, the thick veil hanging in the holy place was ripped in two. Then Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Father, I surrender my spirit into your hands." And he took his last breath and died. When the Roman captain overseeing the crucifixion witnessed all that took place, he was awestruck and glorified God. Acknowledging what they had done, he said, "I have no doubt we just killed the righteous one." The crowds that had gathered to observe this spectacle went back to their homes, overcome with deep sorrow and devastated by what they had witnessed. But standing off at a distance were some who truly knew Jesus, and the women who had followed him all the way from Galilee were keeping vigil.
Okay. And then in John 19:30, it says, when he had sipped the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." Then he bowed his head and surrendered his spirit to God. So one thing I noticed is that John, John is the one that doesn't really talk about women being off to the side, but the other ones do. John is the one that doesn't talk about the centurion, but the other three do. But they all talk about him crying out at the end. And a lot of times, and I've done like study and taught on how Jesus said, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me? And that's often, you know, focused on a lot. But then his last words, some of the gospels, say that he let out a loud cry, right? And gave up his last breath. Others, he said that he, cried out in a loud voice. Two of them talk about him crying out and saying, "It's finished," or "To you I give my spirit." And so it's interesting to read those four accounts. And a lot of people have used in the past that the Gospels are different, so it must not be true. You know, like they try to find these discrepancies in the Bible, they try to find these things, well, these don't really fully match up. But you've got these people doing these different accounts and focusing on different perspectives or different important things. And so I liked, that's why I read that in the very beginning. I like how that that one article was talking about like the importance of them. They do match on so many things, and it's not exactly the same, or they would be the exact same book and written by the same person. And they might have different focuses or miss little details in one and catch other ones in another. And I think that's why it helps to make it so credible that you have different people who have probably heard these stories or witnessed them themselves or talked to these women that were there, and then, you know, piecing those together. But I really, I appreciated how it was saying that he gave up his spirit, or into your hands I give my spirit. And so it was like at that moment, Jesus was saying, I'm letting go, right? I mean, everything that he went through, everything that he suffered through, for him to have survived that up to the point that he did, is miraculous, you know, just in and of itself. And so, you know, some of the other people who are on the crosses next to him, the other two men, I don't think they weren't beaten like Jesus was, right? So he was beaten so severely, and we know that, you know, like flesh and torn and down to the, you know, muscle and bone, all of that, and so much pain. Then to carry that cross and all of that, and still he was the one that at the point it was supposed to happen to give up his spirit. And he said, now it's finished. And he yielded his spirit. He gave up his spirit. He was in full control of himself through this. You know, he was his, how do you say, his Godhead was not taken away from him. And so it is miraculous that he went through that determination, that reliance. But he also, though he suffered that pain, I think it also points to like he was God and he knew what, when it was supposed to happen, right? And he was connected to the Father and the plans that were happening, if that makes sense. I think it's interesting that all of them that reference that, to you I commit my spirit, I give it up. To you I yield my spirit. And then other ones will say like, he gave up his spirit. And I think that's really important. It doesn't just say that he died, right? He chose in that moment, it's done. The other thing that I thought was really amazing, John is the one that doesn't reference this, but the other three do, is about the centurion. And this is really what struck me reading through Matthew. I was talking to Mom yesterday, and I was just saying that there was a scripture that had stuck out to me I wanted to talk about, and luckily I was able to find it. I'd forgotten to write it down. But that idea of the centurion and the soldiers that are with him recognizing and declaring and saying out loud, this is the Son of God. Like the earthquake that's happening, the light dims. I don't know, you know, exactly what else they saw. You know, Matthew, like I was saying in the article, Matthew was very focused on writing to show the majesty and power of God. And so his account goes into more detail about what was happening on that day, right? And several of them talk about the veil being torn, but he goes into like the tombs being open and bodies walking around. And so I wonder what exactly they saw right there. I mean, this was, you know, Golgotha. This is where people were, you know, crucified. This is where probably close around there were dead bodies and there were tombs, and that was the area. And so who knows what else they saw? They don't go into a lot of other detail. But the fact that these centurions and these soldiers who were Romans, who had witnessed, I mean, they knew who Jesus was, you know, they'd witnessed him being brutalized and killed, but they knew about what he did. They knew how the Jews were against him. And you think the Romans, you know, they believed in so many gods, right? That was part of their culture. And so in that, then to recognize the power that's happening around them, and then to say, truly, this was the Son of God. Another one, this was the Son of God. This was a righteous man. And so that recognition, I think, is really powerful. And powerful that it was placed in these accounts, because I think those are some of the details that give these gospels and these accounts credibility. Because that's a risk in and of itself, you know, to write down something. And though these books were written a lot longer after, but to say like that Romans started recognizing that he was, that's a risk. You know, the Romans were not followers of Jesus. They weren't connected to the Jewish faith and all of that stuff. And they were lording their power over these people. And then to say that they recognized that he was God, mm-hmm. I think is a part of what gives it credibility. You know, it's a risk to put that in there. The next thing that that it does. All of them, well, John doesn't, but the other three do, talk about the women that were standing off at the distance, right? Some of them reference their names, which a lot of times in those histories and, you know, in genealogies and a lot of stuff in that the Jewish culture was so patriarchal that women were left out of the stories, right? It didn't matter the women's accounts. And so knowing that the women were there, referencing them by name, putting them into the history, and then going on that it was Mary Magdalene who first sees him and using that as evidence that it actually happened is another thing that gives this credibility, that it actually took place. And so as we read these different accounts, though they're different, there are many similarities, but they have these different focuses, different perspectives. And it's something for me that I want to delve into a little bit more, you know, what they were really trying to draw out in that. But I think more and more as I'm reading them, you know, and I've read these many times, like these gospels, like it's amazing how we can read them over and over again and still new things pop up, you know, new enlightenments, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. So those are some things that I pulled out. The fact that he gave up his spirit, which I think is just powerful in and of itself. The centurion recognizing that this was God. And you just think about, again, the power that they must have witnessed. You know, an earthquake happens right at that moment. The sun has been dimmed for no other reason than it's been dimmed. And then all of a sudden, like, dead people who are dead are now walking around. You know, like, it'd be really, really crazy to be there in that moment. And instead of them just being terrified and running away, they were awestruck and recognizing this must be God. And though they've worshipped and probably, I mean, sacrificed to different gods and worshipped different gods and whatever, you know, their pagan religion that they held to, this was something out of the ordinary, right? So, like, they hadn't seen this kind of power. And I'm sure that there was witchcraft and they had seen, you know, different people doing, you know, crazy things around that time. But this, there was something about this that pointed to God saying, like, this is my son. And then, you know, the women being there all the way to the end. Like, how crazy is that? Like, a lot of other people had left, yeah, right? And so that the women had stayed there, mm-hmm, to the end. You know, some of his dearest, you know, disciples, you know, had left and were afraid. And so they were there, and people knew that they followed Jesus. They've been following him for 3 years. And a lot of these women that were following him in this crew were also people who financially backed him up, which is crazy too. So they were financial backers, but they loved him, you know? And so to watch somebody you love be brutalized and then hanging on a cross and watching their last breath, the pain that would be in that witnessing, but also the draw to be there till the end because they loved him so dearly. And they didn't know he was coming back, you know, in 3 days. And so to, how do I say it? I think I was struck by the pain of watching that, you know, and people deal with things differently. But the pain of watching that and still staying there, you know, instead of, like, I don't know, leaving away in fear or leaving away because it was just too hard, they stuck with him to the end. And I feel like that shows beautiful connection. So those are some things. So I wanted to just hear from you guys, like, what you feel like, you know, after reading the article and just kind of going through these, what is the power of having these four gospels? You know, if we just had one, what's the power of having all four?
I think it's perspective, right? Personal perspective. You know, when you were talking about how, like, people want to use because it doesn't rightly match up, that it, like, discredits it, I think it actually adds more truth to it, because the way that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John are all going to see things are going to be different, right? And so, like, certain things are going to be pointed out more per each perspective based off the personal relationship they had with Jesus, you know? And I think it's, like, so it makes sense that it's not going to, like, connect like a perfect jigsaw puzzle, because you have that, those different perspectives. You know, and not only that, to point out the fact that they all talk about his last breath, I think it does show that there was that personal connection, there was that pain, because they all emphasized on how important that was. So I think it's just like, that's something that we need to take in and like our own personal accounts of Jesus as well, you know, and how that gospel applies to us, because we could be going through a season where what John is writing about doesn't mean crap to us. However, like what Luke is saying, maybe there's connection with us based off the season or the things we're going through. So I think it's extremely important that we have perspective, because if we just had a tunnel vision, single-sided account of the gospel, it would be really hard to create a personal and intimate relationship with the word. Mm-hmm. It would be extremely hard, you know, because it's not a novel. It's not a, you know, that's not Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter, where you pick it up and you know the story and you know what's going to happen because it's tunnel, right? It's only from one perspective.
Yeah. Awesome. Those are powerful points. Other thoughts, Aaron or Mom?
I think, what is it?
Yeah.
Sorry, Mom, do you want to say something?
No, you go ahead.
I was just saying, there's one point Jesus is confronted and they're talking to him about, like, how dare you basically call yourself Son of God, right? And he says, well, how many witnesses are required for like proof of something, right? And at the end, I mean, he says, I think, to the effect that, like, even if it were just him witnessing, but it's not, his father's also witness. And he mentions kind of strange things. I'm just thinking, like, in a sense, like, there's the necessity of multiple witnesses, you know, that like me and Nikki listen to like crime, you know, these podcasts about crime, right? And like they find like they'll convict somebody based upon one witness's testimony, and at the end of the day, oftentimes the testimony is like not enough. They find out that the person was innocent. What?
Are you talking about going yesterday?
Yeah.
She was six.
It's like a six, you know, yeah. But like a six-year-old, you know, gives testimony. And anyways, the reality is that like each individual, like Matthew is different than John. And they're going to see different things. Kind of what you're saying, Jake. They're going to see different things. And in fact, like a certain sound distracts John and he sees something different, totally different. Because there's some things in the Gospels that people try to pull out and be like, well, those don't line up. Like kind of what you were saying, Josh. There are other things that happen in the Gospels where it looks like they conflict as well. And granted, I think that you're probably missing the fact that like they're seeing absolutely, they're not trying to say something different about the same thing. They're actually seeing something different. You know, like I think sometimes we confuse that, but like for the death of Jesus, like, I mean, I think it's really beautiful. Like that the Holy Spirit works with the uniquenesses of Matthew and Mark and John and Luke. And Luke, who was not a witness, he was a historian. He wrote this after the fact. He collected data and did research. So it's, his is even different. His isn't even necessarily, his is based on eyewitness accounts, but his isn't a personal eyewitness account. So, and his has got some of the most detail, which is kind of striking in that respect. Because he was an intelligent human being and he knew how to compile information and do research. And I don't know. I think there's something beautiful about like you, if you read the Gospels, you get to actually get to know the man, you know,
Yeah.
Like, John is one of those ones, it's not a synoptic, not synoptic, is that what it's called? It's not a synoptic gospel. It's got a number of things in it that are different than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are going to have a lot of the same, more of the similar stories, and John's perspective is different. And if you think about, like, the later of who John is, like, he's the one that, like, has the visions that Revelation comes out of. Like, his investment in the story is different than Matthew's investment in the story. And so, like, not only do you get eyewitness accounts, you also get, like, the uniquenesses of people that actually followed Jesus and got to witness him, lay their head upon him, you know. Ask him questions, all the conversations that weren't recorded. You know how it says in the end of which gospel does it say, like, if all of the things Jesus had done had been recorded, it would fill all the libraries up, you know, like, just this kind of like thing of, like, you're only getting a glimpse of what to do.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just beautiful to me.
What were you thinking, Mom?
What Aaron just talked about, where if everything was written, the world could not contain it. That is John, which is really awesome. I was just thinking, it's like, for me, it's like the fullness of the gospel. When you're reading, you know, when you're seeing it in from different perspectives, it's the fullness of the gospel. It's God's revelation to different people and the unique way they express that revelation. It's kind of like, you know, if you were looking at a flower and you look from only one side, you see a part of it. But then you move over to the other side and you see a different part. And then from the back, you see another part. It gives us the full picture of who Jesus is and what he did. I love that. I love that. And I think one of my favorite parts of when he died, that it talks about the veil being torn, and the veil separating the common people from the Holy of Holies, you know, and that it was ripped apart from top to bottom. And I always get this picture of some little guy going in there and pulling on this curtain. Of course, this curtain is like, it's not just a curtain. I mean, it is so thick. I can't remember what, like a foot thick or whatever. It is just, it's massive. And, you know, thinking of this little guy going and trying to pull this curtain apart right from the bottom, like man making their way to God. But it's God ripped it from top to bottom for us. That's what Jesus did, so we can just come in fully to his presence. Mm-hmm. And I really love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It says it was one hand breadth thick.
So a big man's hand?
Yeah, I imagine.
Maybe 6 inches, maybe then?
Yeah, you think about like, that is so thick. I mean,
I know. Yeah.
Every layer is like stronger, right? So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty incredible.
Amazing. Yeah.
I think, you know, like, really. Like all of you guys have said, like, I think one of the things, like, just the connection, those perspectives, understanding Jesus more, understanding their connection with him. And like you said, Aaron, like, I mean, Luke is written as a historian, you know, he wasn't one walking with him, and John was the one that Jesus loved, and says that Matthew was writing more from like Peter's kind of stories and like hearing like Peter's, he spent a lot of time with Peter, you know, and so they have these different flavors that they're going from. And I think it is interesting that what really gives it strength is what people, like I said in the beginning, what some people try to use as why it's not, you know, and people are trying to like poke holes. And so many people say like, oh, you know, like Christianity is so, chauvinist and it's just all about men. And you're like, then you're not really reading it, you know, like over and over again, like women are valued by Jesus, not by the culture, but by Jesus, you know? And because, you know, God made sure that women were placed in there, were honored, you know, throughout the Bible. I mean, just things like that, that some people take so out of context, but they're not looking at the whole picture and they're not really seeing Jesus for who he is and how these multiple perspectives reveal him and also how he treated people. You know, like, I mean, John brought in so much, you know, story about people and connection with Jesus. And I think people just take these snippets of things that they hear or what they want to believe and use those to discredit. But I've never really sat and thought, you know, about the power of having the four gospels. I mean, I've heard people talk about how they're different and stuff, but really the power of having the four and how it really brings credibility to his death and his resurrection. And though some details are different, like they all talk about his death and they all talk about his resurrection, you know, and that's the pinnacle of everything. Mm-hmm. You know, if they had a different agenda, you know, or they were just writing a different story, or trying to do their own thing, they wouldn't be matching up on those powerful things the way that they do either, you know, just be a totally different take on history, whatever they wanted to put in, you know? And so having those different flavors that they focused on, but yet getting to the same point, the same focus, at the end of their books building up to, you know, Jesus's life, that was the pinnacle. That was everything. You know, his death and resurrection is everything, you know, for us. So
I personally feel too, like if everything matched up exactly the same, I feel like that would cause more suspicion than if they didn't. Right.
Absolutely.
Because then you're like, okay, cause if the way that I write a paper is going to be different from the way Aaron writes it and so on and so forth. So I feel like it'd be suspicious. Like you're a teacher. Like if you have two kids that have a paper and the voice is very similar, aren't you like, okay, man, like what's going on here? This is sketchy.
Yep.
So I feel if the Gospels were written in the same tone of voice, same feel, everything was the same, and only small variations of the perspective has changed, I'd be like, okay, like this. They're either covering something up or they're trying to get their story straight enough to where it seems believable. And to me at that point, I could question and be like, is this legitimate or is this all like corroborated lies?
Yeah.
To me, that's more likely to be fake than small variations that seem off because they're different. I mean, the way that, you know, Jake, like Tolkien writes versus C.S. Lewis are way different. If they had the same writing voice, then you'd be like, okay, they're not different authors. It's the same dude writing two different books using a different name.
Yeah.
You know, I personally feel like that's obvious, and it's crazy to me that people aren't like calculating that. I don't know. But then I guess if you're upset and you like have some sort of malice in you that you just want to find disproof, you know what they say, you could make any conspiracy sound true if you look deep enough.
Yeah.
I mean, if I want to, I could probably prove that Pokemon are real if I look for enough stuff to come up with evidence.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And that's, you know, even nowadays, like on social media, like you can find anything that's going to support what you want to believe, you know? And so depending on how you're going into something, and that, you know, these have lasted the test of time. Like it's quite incredible. And I think sometimes for me, I read these things and I read the Bible and I sometimes don't stop and really think about like how powerful of a book and how powerful that it came together and how powerful that it really paints a whole picture, And still stuff is super confusing in some parts for me, for sure. I don't understand it all.
Well, I think historically we have one of the Gospels that was written, like handwritten, like 30 years after the events that we have. And it matches up with another Gospel that we have 500 years after the fact. So, you know, obviously translations and people who are writing it, obviously like different mannerisms are going to change, but everything else is lined up the same. I don't think that's by accident. Yeah. You know, when you play the game telephone, things change drastically. Yeah. But it's something this divine that's been able to correctively, if I'm saying this correctly, stay consistent throughout history, whether it's 30 years to 500 years to 2,000 years, and everything's lining up the same, there has to be a reason for that. There's something protecting that message. That doesn't happen on accident.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Good point.
Yep.
So.